Court. Good morning. My name is Kim Carley, representing LaShonda Mott. This is a case, Your Honors, where the law is not in dispute. I think both parties have briefed the applicable standards very well. The issue in this case, and it is a factual one, it's for the court to have to distinguish between the probability of a serious harm befalling the children in this case versus the possibility that any harm could befall the children in this case. I think that is the standard that we are operating under. And it's not enough for the trial court to be able to look at the facts and say, well, something could have happened. We could dream up any number of scenarios under which something bad could have happened to these children when they were alone. We have to look at the very specific facts of this case to see what not only the mother knew about the possible or probable harms that could befall the children, but we have to look at the nature of what those harms could be and how serious they actually would have been. So I think there's two main categories that the court has to focus on when we're looking at the facts, and that's how the children came to be alone, and correlated to that is what the mother knew about that situation. And then the second set is the circumstances of the room itself and the circumstances of how the children were left. Starting with the first part, component of that is how the children came to be alone and what the mother knew about it. What we know is that Ms. Mott is not the primary party who actually left the children alone to begin with. That was actually, Mr. Wiggins, a friend of Ms. Mott's. She left them with Mr. Wiggins, and Mr. Wiggins subsequently left them alone. Mr. Wiggins was forthcoming about the fact that he did not try to contact Ms. Mott or inform her in any way, shape, or form that he was leaving. The testimony.
Didn't he tell her that he had to go to work the next morning?
So, yes, Your Honor, and that's exactly what I was about to talk about, was the testimony that we had about him going to work or him needing to be at work in the morning. That's really what we have. We have testimony that he was supposed to go to work. We don't know, we don't have any more concrete testimony or evidence that she knew that he was, in fact, going to leave to go to work. Certainly, people have to go to work, don't always show up. And when you have deprived them of their primary means of transportation, that certainly is one circumstance under which maybe they're not going to go to work. So in the testimony from the officer, and that's really where that came out, was from the police officer, and they went back and forth with the officer's testimony between direct and cross-examination about what Ms. Mott actually communicated. And it started off with, she told me that she knew he was going to leave, but then when confronted that's not actually what she said. That's maybe what the officer understood her to mean, but that's not what she actually said. And we don't have the exact words that she used. We only have the officer's summary of what he understood. So what we really have is a situation where, yes, he was supposed to go to work, but we don't know what Ms. Mott actually believed as far as whether he was going to leave. And actually, I would submit that the evidence is stronger that she did not believe he was actually going to leave because she had his truck. Obviously, he did end up going to work by walking, but he testified that it took him about an hour to do so. So that's a pretty extreme, I'd say, method of getting yourself to work.
But she didn't actually return with his truck until very late that day.
That is correct. And again, I would just reiterate that he did not take any steps to inform her or to reach out to her. And he even testified that, I thought she was still on the premises. I thought she was nearby. He didn't make an effort to go look for her and say, hey, I'm about to leave. Your kids are alone. So there was no effort on his behalf to reach out to her. If she had gotten direct communication that they were alone and that the Commonwealth had that evidence, certainly this would be a much stronger case. But really what we have is very convoluted testimony about what she knew. And again, she is not the primary person who actually left the children.
Because they were her children. Right?
They were her children.
And
that is correct. That is correct. She obviously has a legal duty, an obligation to look after them, certainly that he may not. But I would submit that, again, this is not a case that we're trying to stand up and say she did the right thing. Obviously, she did not. But what our argument is, and there have been cases that we've cited to that make the same point, that this is not a statute that criminalizes bad parenting. This is an example of bad parenting. No one's going to try to argue otherwise. But it requires something more than that. that to get to the felony gross negligence criminal threshold. And so moving on, looking then to the circumstances of the room itself and the children in the room and what the evidence was, and there really wasn't a lot of evidence in this case. It wasn't a very complicated case. There's not many facts that the Commonwealth introduced. What we know is they're in a hotel room. Presumably it's their hotel room. This is where they're staying. It's no different, really, than if they were in their own home or their own apartment. This is their residence. There was food and clothing in the room. The food may not have been plentiful, and it may not have been the most nutritious, but what we could tell from the pictures that were introduced as evidence or in the appendix, there was what appeared to be like already cooked kind of sausage product there, so nothing that would have required the children to, you know, use any kind of means to cook them. There was a bag of candy on the dresser in the hotel room. Certainly the hotel room had given them access to water. So there were the basic, you know, things there that they're not in a situation where they're running the risk of starving to death or anything like that. There was alcohol in the room, some open container, not any indication whether it was empty or full, and there were some closed containers. Common household item, going to be found in many homes across the country, and not something that in and of itself would raise this to that felony threshold. And then we get to the issue of the quote-unquote weapons. We have a BB gun or an airsoft gun. It wasn't exactly clear what specifically it was, but it wasn't a real gun. That's what we know for sure. And the testimony from Ms. Mott was that it was not functional, and there was no testimony from the Commonwealth to rebut that. So we have a non-functional item that looks like a gun, could have been a toy or looked like a toy gun or a BB gun, but in any event, it doesn't present any danger in and of itself. There was no testimony that the children knew about it, had used it, had any predilection towards picking up weapons or doing anything with weapons. And then there was a reference to there being a pocket knife somewhere in the room, but they could not say where it was found and whether it was really somewhere where the children would have been able to see it, know it was there, access it. And again, no information about these particular children and whether or not they had any kind of issues with weapons or prior behavioral issues like that. And again, both of these things, a BB gun, a pocket knife, common items, common household items. There's nothing about them that is inherently dangerous. So, and obviously, we have to look at the totality of the circumstances and view the light and the evidence most favorable to the Commonwealth. But what I would ask this court to look at and focus on, too, is the lack of evidence, the things that we're missing here. Again, we don't know anything about the children except their ages. We don't know anything about their behaviors or their past. We don't know what they knew. We don't know if they even knew that these items were in there. We don't know when the last time they ate was. We don't know what they ate. We don't know if maybe there had been more food in the room. And they ate it prior to the police getting there. We don't have those answers.
Wouldn't there be some signs? I mean, kids 1, 3, 5, and 7 don't exactly clean up and wash up after they've had a nice meal.
And the room was in a state of disrepair, I should say. You know, there were utensils, there were plates and cups and things scattered throughout. So just because the police didn't take specific note or take specific pictures doesn't necessarily mean that that's not a reasonable hypothesis. We also don't know how the room was secured when Mr. Wiggins left, and I think that is important. The Commonwealth, at the trial level, one of the things they argued or attempted to argue is, you know, the police officer just walked up to an open room and there's children in there, and I think that's a little far-fetched to think that the door was just wide open and the children could have run out. Clearly, someone called the police, so someone must have come upon the children at some point, and I think that's a more reasonable interpretation of that set of facts. But I think the bottom line for the appellant at this point is we have very little evidence. The evidence that we do have is about common items, common household items. We have 4 children who are alone, but it was not Ms. Mott who was the primary party responsible for leaving them alone. And to have to speculate about the substantial harm or the substantial risk of serious harm, that's what the trial court did. It was speculating as to all of these things that potentially could have gone terribly wrong. But that's all it was, is speculation. There was no facts that the court could look at and say, under this particular set of facts, this is a serious harm. This something really, really serious was going to happen to these children. It's nothing more, our position is that this is nothing more than children being left alone in the equivalent of an average household, which, again, could potentially be sufficient for a conviction upon the facts and circumstances of each individual case, but this case is just lacking in those details for the court to say that the evidence was sufficient. Is there any questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have your rebuttal. Good morning, Mr. Stallard.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Craig Stallard on behalf of the Commonwealth. First, I'd like to address the claim that it's not Mrs. Mott's. She's not the one who actually left the children. Mr. Wiggins testified at trial. He did not say that he had any type of agreement with Ms. Mott to watch the children. In fact, what his testimony was, he loaned her his truck so that she could go to the Dollar Tree and then come back. When he awoke the next morning, when she left earlier, her purse was not there. Her purse was there in the room. He assumed that she had returned, so he went to work, which is what he was supposed to do, and I think good for him for going to work even without the truck. He's got a responsibility. He took that seriously. It was Ms. Mott whose children was there. If she did not expect to return, she should have said, "Hey, Mr. Wiggins, if you got to go to work tomorrow, don't go to work. If I'm not here, I will pay you for your time." To make some kind of deal or agreement that, like, make sure the children are being watched. She did not do that. Mr. Wiggins did not testify to any type of agreement, any type of understanding that it was his responsibility to watch her children. He said, "I have to go to work." There's no counter argument that, "Hey, I might not be back. I want you to watch the kids." She did nothing to attempt to make sure the kids were taken care of if he went to work. And I think it's also important to remember that the kids were left unattended for almost 9 to 10 hours. Even in a household where there's common items that can cause injury, it's not as much of a problem if there's adult supervision at the same time. Here, the children were completely devoid of any type of supervision, so something that might be innocuous in a household with an adult present, we don't have that safeguard here. We have a 1-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 7-year-old. If one of them were to drink alcohol, if one of them were to find the pocket knife, if one of them were to open the door and wander out in the parking lot, there's nobody there capable of correcting the measure or minimizing any damage. This is an entirely different situation than someone just being at their house, presumably, I mean, especially with adult supervision. It's the lack of adult supervision coupled with the conditions of the house and the length of time the children were left unsupervised, which all work together to create criminal negligence. Which is what the standard is here. And the Commonwealth has cited the case of Barnes versus Commonwealth, which is admittedly a different statute. But in that case, leaving 2 children ages 2 and 4 left alone while the mother went to go to the grocery store, the court in that case found that was criminal negligence because when the children woke up, they didn't know where their parent was. There was any number of situations that could have incurred where not knowing where the mom is or the parent is can lead to the probability of harm. And the longer the children are left unattended, the more probable that harm becomes. Now, merely because the children were not injured in this case does not mean there was not criminal negligence, because we obviously the Commonwealth doesn't have to prove any actual injuries. But because of the length of time, the fact that she left the children there, and that there were factors in that room that made it likely or probable that harm would occur to the children, that the Commonwealth proved beyond a reasonable doubt that there was, in fact, criminal negligence on the part of Ms. Mott. And unless the court has any additional questions, I'd ask this court to affirm.
You made the analogy to if children were left alone at home over a period of hours. Isn't this somewhat different from that? Because they're in a motel and can go, all kinds of other people could be there.
True. Presumably, if the children are at a home, they might know the neighbors, they might have some other avenue, like which is the case that happened in Barnes, where the children did go to a neighbor's house and the neighbor is able to contact somebody. Here, it's unknown if there's anybody nearby that they knew, anybody that they would not necessarily even know how to get help if they needed it. Again, we don't know the maturity level. We don't know if they were aware of how to call 911. So I agree, Honor, that it's, to the extent the two are similar, the hotel room would probably be even more probable of harm than even being at the house left unattended. If the court has any other questions?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Stout.
I'd like to affirm. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Carr, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. Just briefly, there were just 3 points that I wanted to make. The Commonwealth raises the issue of Ms. Mott having some kind of duty to make an agreement with Mr. Wiggins to watch the children. Again, certainly while that would have been preferable, I don't think her failure to do that in this case, again, raises it to the level of criminal negligence. We have to look at what Ms. Mott knew or what Ms. Mott understood, and the evidence there is woefully inadequate to for us to say that she knew that they were going to be alone for the 9 to 10 hours that they ended up being alone. If she didn't know that, if that was not her expectation or her belief, then I don't think we have a willful act here under the statute. And then the final thing is the length of time that they were, in fact, alone. Again, I think the evidence is a fair interpretation is it was somewhere between 9 to 10 hours, probably closer to 9, that they ended up being alone. But our point would be if serious harm is probable to happen to the children over the course of 9 hours, that same kind of harm is probable to happen to them over the course of 1 hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. And then we're left in a situation where we're just kind of arbitrarily drawing lines between how many hours is too much. I think, you know, as people, we can probably all agree that any amount of time is too much as a standard of, you know, just what it would take to be a good parent. But again, to get to the standard of criminal negligence under this felony statute, while we have to look at the totality of the circumstances, the length of time, I think, is a bit of a red herring. So, thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Carl. We will recounsel, and then the next case.